meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com. It's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
And good evening. Have you been following the James Brown estate? It's been in the news. It's been on all the tabloid websites, Entertainment Tonight, you name it. For lack of a better term, it's a mess. I'm looking at a webpage right now called The Investment News. And the title of the article that I'm reading here right now says, James Brown Estate is a Real Mess. Not unlike the man, it sounds like the estate is in just a poor condition. Of course, Brown died at the age of 73 on Christmas Day. And there's all sorts of things going on right now. I thought I would go to Jackie Hollander. Of course, Jackie is a victims' rights advocate. Jackie did take the Brown, James Brown, to court over a rape that occurred. We've done that story many times, but I thought I'd bring on Jackie tonight to talk about the James Brown estate because she is very familiar with it. Jackie, how are you?
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
A little cold down here.
Yeah, for sure. Of course, you're talking to me here in Saskatchewan, and we're, I think minus 25 outside right now. Now the estate, the James Brown estate, and I'm not trying to be flip, but I think it's adequate comparison to say the estate is like the man. It's it's just a freaking mess right now. What can you tell us? What's going on? What do you know?
Well, you hit me with one here tonight, Dana. So I guess I'm just going to, your show has been very good to me through the course of this time, and I know that it's only a matter of probably days before this probably breaks open anyway. So I'm going to go ahead, I think, and spill some of the beans here.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen the actual will, and of course, don't know what it says. However, just recently, I was informed of the name of the trust fund that Mr. Brown, I guess you would say, relinquished all of his belongings to,
right,
and all of his funds and everything else, and it really took me aback, probably because I am the one that came up with the name for the estate, and I mean the trust fund, and I created it.
Tell us about
Mr.
that.
Brown and Mr. Dallas prior to my rape.
Now, who's Mr. Dallas, Jackie, for those that aren't familiar? I know who he is, but let's share that with the audience.
Buddy Dallas was James Brown's lawyer through the years. And he was appointed by James Brown to be the trustee of the estate. And there are 27 lawyers, I think, as of this count right now, representing children of Mr. Brown, representing the Tommy Ray, who claimed to be Mr. Brown's wife with a child, and then, of course, representing the children that are coming forth that claim to be, through DNA, Mr. Brown's children. And of course, they are claiming that Mr. Brown was coerced into putting everything he owned and all of his funds into this trust fund. And I can assure you tonight that not only do I have proof that I created it, but Mr. Brown was not coerced. Trust me, I looked at the end of a gun with Mr. Brown during my rape. There was no way to coerce James Brown, and I can assure you that Buddy Dallas, and I was there when Mr. Brown was in the meeting with us and saying what he wanted done with everything, and there was no coercion against Mr. Brown. Anybody that truly knows James Brown can tell you that there was no coercing this man.
Now, Jackie, this was done approximately what year? And, of course, trust funds are one thing, but there's an estate with property and all that sort of stuff. What can you tell us about that? And I'm not sure if, because this is in litigation right now, if you can tell us some of the details as far as what was supposed to go where, but we'd certainly be interested if you can.
You know, I don't know what his will said because I have not seen it, and I have deliberately not looked at it. I have been told that you can pull it up on TMZ. I have not done that because I wanted to be able to only say what I personally know, what I personally was a part of. What was in the meeting that I was in, and this wasn't just done one time. It was numerous times that Mr. Brown would say this to me and Mr. Dallas. One, because obviously even during that time, Mr. Brown had a lot of serious problems. And was very paranoid that his life was not going to, you know, he was constantly thinking that he was going to die.
Why was he thinking that, Jackie? Can you speculate, or do you know why he was in that state of mind?
He had a drug problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think any time that you have a drug problem like that, you become paranoid of, you know, your surroundings.
Okay. Now, Tommy Ray, we talked about, and it looks like from the information I have here, there's a six-year-old son. Has that six-year-old son through DNA been proven to be James Brown's?
To my knowledge, and of course I am not down there, and nor have I been a part of the ongoing litigation, you know, she has not submitted any DNA after even a year. And so, you know, you have to question why somebody waits that long.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, you know, everybody has their own game plan to how they're going to do it. To me, I really think that this is coming down to, I think a will is something that people leave. This doesn't have, I'm not here rooting for James Brown. Please don't think that.
No.
I'm rooting for all of us. When you do a will, and you say, this is what I want to do with everything I own, then it should be a simple tier of fact. And the information that I have 100% supports what Mr. Dallas took into the courts.
What is that information that you have, or can you share that with us?
Well, I mean, you know, I created the trust fund.
Mm-hmm.
That, ironically, all the money has gone to. as a victim of Mr. Brown, I was very shocked when I found out a couple of weeks ago.
How did you find out? Did you talk to the attorney or?
I received. I have not over the past year, as you know, I have been more fighting for the laws of victims. And, of course, we do have a new law here in my state. I'm very, very excited.
Right.
But I just was not following it. And I got a phone call about 7 o'clock in the morning from a news reporter. And they were just basically asking me about, you know, questions about the things that were going on down there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just kind of chit chat. It wasn't really a call to inform me of anything. And they mentioned the name of the trust fund, and I almost dropped the phone.
I'll bet you did.
You know, it was like, oh my God! And I had to really get off the phone because I instantly knew what the trust fund was.
Now, this trust fund, when it was set up, it was meant for who or what?
It was meant for all of the children, the needy children, and disabled and kids that had nothing.
And when you say that, is a specific organization or
no? It was specifically to go to children's charities in Georgia and in South Carolina. Of course, I have not seen the will. Please again understand that what I am telling you is coming straight from the meetings that I was in with Mr. Brown and Mr. Dallas. And those were his words. No one coerced Mr. Brown. At one point, Mr. Dallas even said, "I'm sorry, Mr. Brown, but you have children of your own, and you have to take care of those children." And Mr. Brown got very irate and came around a table and was screaming at Mr. Dallas that nobody was going to tell him what to do, that nobody was going to make a I'm not going to get into that right now.
I understand. I understand. But we're talking about tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars.
That's correct.
That you say was benchmarked, if I can use that term, for the needy, needy children. And the stories that we see in the media on TMZ and other places, the Entertainment Tonight shows, etc., is, you know, the fight is going on with the family, people being locked out of the mansion. James Brown's legacy, I guess, being compared to that of Elvis Presley and that type of honor being put on him, which many of us roll our eyes about. And it seems like what was decided way back when is gone out the window, and now it becomes an ugly fight with the family, and you're saying that that was never his wishes in the first place.
I have a tape, and that tape, I am sure, is going to end up in the courtroom. And I have the proof. And, you know, it is probably the last thing anyone in the world would have ever expected is for me and me to even, you know, come out. But I had to go through a lot of thinking, and I had to do a lot of soul searching, and this doesn't have anything to do with me. It doesn't have anything to do with my feelings of the past 20 years of what I've endured. This has to do with children. This has to do with the truth. And as a victim, it's really put me in a really very very traumatizing position, but it's the truth, and it needs to be where it's a fear of fact is what it is. That's what this will and the argument is coming down to, is a simple tier of fact, and we have it.
Well, yeah, to make this very clear, and you and I have done many shows on this, and of course we've talked about the rape where you were raped at gunpoint by James Brown, and the rape to the Supreme Court and all of that. But what you're saying now, and I want to make this perfectly clear, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that you are going to do what you can to ensure that Mr. Brown's wishes are fulfilled. So that must be terribly difficult on you.
You know, I'm not even looking at it as James Brown. I'm actually blocking that part of that out of this, and I'm looking at the children.
Right.
When you're talking millions and millions and millions of dollars, and of course I have spent many, many hours with terminally ill children and granted wishes for them and worked with the veterans and seen the pain and suffering in their eyes of the children that can't even make a bologna sandwich. I get really disgusted when I see all of these people down there in the courts hiring all these lawyers that probably are, trust me, having more than a bologna sandwich tonight for dinner.
I believe it.
That's when I have to look up and say, you know, I'm going to bring the evidence in, I'm going to drop it, and let it be where it is. This comes down to the children of our country. It comes down to two states that have suffered from hurricanes, everything else. Their little children have, Georgia has one of the highest leukemia rates with children down at the Medical College of Georgia. I have to put aside my pain, and I have to say, their pain comes before me at this moment in time.
Now, Jackie, just in our last few minutes here, if you're just tuning in, Jackie Hollander's here, and we're talking about the story of James Brown's estate that you've seen in the Hollywood media, some of the tabloid press included, and the mess that it is. You talk about a tape. Is that an audio tape, videotape?
It is a videotape.
It is a videotape. And you've been in discussion with the attorneys as far as turning this over as evidence or whatever?
There have been numerous conversations over the past 2 weeks. You know, it's been a continuous thing. We've tried to keep it quiet, but I think now it's probably, well, I know now talking to you, it's probably out of the genie, the bottle's out, or whatever. Genie's out of the bottle.
Right. And again, this is going to be, it is a big story, because again, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, if not more, and the wishes of the late singer James Brown. But just in our last minute or so here, Jackie, I want to talk about you a little bit here. What you've gone through for all of these years, you're a champion for victims' rights right now, and you've helped pass legislation. You've gone through all this, and now you're reliving it all over again. I guess it never stops, but to have this going through your mind now, being refreshed again because of this whole will or trust fund issue in the courts, how is that affecting you, and are you able to handle it okay?
A lot of sleepless nights, a lot of prayers to God, a lot of reading the Bible, a lot of difficulty with many, many memories coming back, many, many painful memories, and it's kind of just brought it all up into my face, more so than my fight to the United States Supreme Court. You know, it's just a very rough road that I am on right now. Very, very, very hard road. But with God's will, maybe everything will work out for the best for all the children of Georgia and all the children of South Carolina, and you know, some good will come from the nightmares.
And this money should go to where it was intended to go to, and if it helps the children, that's the important thing. Jackie Hollander, it's always a pleasure having you on the show, and we'll stay in touch.
Dina, it was a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you.
Okay, take care.
You have a good night.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Jackie Hollander, and this whole James Brown estate is, you know, all you have to do is follow TMZ or some of those other websites, and you'll see that it's a mess. And it's interesting to see that Jackie has a videotape. A lot of these audio tapes are into question, but we're talking about video. This is the Scared Monkeys Radio Network. We're going to be back in a minute with the author of the book Into the Deep, Andrew Hodges. Andrew was in Aruba recently helping with the search, the underwater search for missing Alabama teen Natalie Holloway, and we're going to check in with Andrew and see what he has to say about that and his thoughts on the investigation. This is the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. And we're back. We had a short delay there. Andrew Hodges is the author of the book Into the Deep. We've had Andrew on the show before, and most recently he was down in Aruba helping out with the search for missing Alabama teen Natalie Holloway. In fact, he was on the boat that's been doing the deep water search for Natalie, and we have Andrew on the line with us. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Dana. Good to be with you.
Now, there may be some things that you can't discuss. I understand that. And for anyone that wants more information on this topic, of course, can go to Dr. Hodges' website. There's a link to it on the show notes for tonight. But you did spend some time in Aruba. We're part of the search, and we have some things to talk about that. First of all, tell us about being down there, and what can you tell us about the search?
Yeah, you know, I was very impressed with the diligence. I think the name, Daniel, the persistence, just fits exactly what's happening. I think, of course, John Silvetti is the boat owner and captain, and he is phenomenally persistent, but the whole crew is very capable, and everybody, I'm sure, has been following the blog on the website. But it's just a very capable, devoted crew. I don't think we've seen a search like this, an underwater search, I guess the Titanic, but beyond that, this is a very, very diligent search. So I was very impressed, and I talked to John a couple of nights ago again, and it's just it's an amazing story, and, you know, they've run into some very rough waters, but I think what's important to note is that during the time that Natalie, that month, May the 30th, when she was dropped off at sea, I think the seas were much calmer, and they could go much further out, so I think that's plan is to just search every square inch. So it's a very impressive search.
And, of course, we should let the listeners know that that search is still going on. There's been some crew changes and all that, but the search is still going on. It hasn't been reported a lot in the media. There's been some, obviously, some reports and some discussion at the Scared Monkeys webpage and, of course, on my show, but they've kept the media somewhat uninformed when it comes to this. And I'm curious, Dr. Hodges, is it because of some of the reaction that they may get down in Aruba, or is this just something that they need to deal with and not have a lot of media involvement?
Well, you know, the day I got there and the day before I went on the boat, December 17th, was the day that they, in fact, I think it was December the 18th, they released the three suspects. And in a way, that was really good for the people doing the search, and they didn't really want to be bothered in a way. They didn't want a lot of media attention. So I think that's been a benefit for them as far as going about their business. I think it's also enabled the Aruban authorities to see that they're just very serious. This is not a media attention sort of thing. This is just a very serious search. And so I think in a lot of ways it's worked out allowed them to go about their business. So While they were disappointed at first, certainly I was, along with other people, that they released the suspects, I think this is an open thing to go about their business. So there's always an upside to it, and that's the upside. So I think that's the good part of it.
Yeah, it's interesting to have that that theory, and it's probably an important one that this isn't just a media stunt. This is actually something very serious that needs to be done, and they're continuing doing it. So I applaud them for that. One thing that I did find interesting, Dr. Hodges, is while you were there, you actually spoke to the fisherman who discovered the break-in and the missing caves at the fisherman huts. Tell us about that.
Excuse me, Donnie, go ahead.
Yeah, tell us about that interview you had with him.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an interesting story because I was on the ship the night before, and the crew was going to be up all night, and, you know, it was a tight squeeze, and so John Silvetti let me sleep in his bed, and he didn't wake me up, and the crew decided to go to bed about 4:30, and he didn't wake me up, and he stayed up asleep in his chair, and I kind of stole his bed, so I felt bad about that. But he and Lewis Schaefer, one of the sponsors, you know, of course, for the search,
sure. They
had been frustrated about not being able to find the exact replica of the cave, so they knew the exact dimensions. And Dave Holloway and I tried from here in the States to get somebody to help them, and it just didn't work out, and to go do the research. So I left the boat and to do some research, and I'm out the next day, and I walk down to fishermen's huts. So bear in mind, nobody's got the exact dimensions of this cage, and they were going on what Tim Miller had come up with and some others. So I'm walking down to fishermen's huts, and there is the one fisherman in Aruba everybody wanted to talk to who was the one who stuck in the missing cage. And I talked to him, and he gave me the dimensions of the cage, and I think I was the first one to go in the fisherman's huts and move it in, and he explained the break-in. It was a really fascinating story, the break-in. But he told me about the cage, and he had spotted the missing cage and was able to give me the dimensions, and I called out to the boat and talked to John, and I said, look, I owe you a favor, and how would you like to know the exact dimensions of the cage as best the fisherman can remember? So he provided the dimensions, and they had a model built within 24 hours and were able to drop it in 100 or so feet of water so they could get a good signature.
And that's fantastic. That's something that needs to be done, and it's a bit mind-boggling, although nothing is surprising, that comes from Aruba, that law enforcement at least didn't come out and talk to this fisherman about this. That just shows you how seriously they're taking the investigation.
Yeah, no, I think they claim to have done that, but they really didn't. And, you know, there are three fishermen's huts. Well, there were four of them. There were four buildings with four huts in each one. And this guy was the first guy on the scene. He was there 6 o'clock the Monday morning, May 30th, and Natalie disappeared. He didn't know anything about it. He spotted the break-in. And he took me through the break-in. If you're facing the huts, there are four of them, left to right. And he took me through the break-in, and the first one, they broke into the one on the left. The one on the right now is the closest to the Holiday Inn. So Holiday Inn, Marriott, Fisherman's Huts, and then we're looking at this first fisherman's hut. It's four units in it. So the first unit, they broke in, a lot of valuables inside, a stove, a cooler, and so forth. They took nothing. Second unit they broke into, but they couldn't get the door open. It was stuck. So they went to the third unit. They broke in the third unit. There was only one item missing, a brand-new large fishing knife. And I show a picture of that on my website, a replica of that. That's inside one of the huts. And they quit. They didn't go on the fourth hut. So all they were looking for was a knife. Where in the world would they need a knife in the middle of the night? I think it was to cut the cage so they could get the body in it. It made a lot of sense to me. So it's so coincidental. The cage goes missing. The break-in occurred that night. They took a big knife. I mean, it just confirms the story. They didn't take any rope, nothing else. They just took the knife. So it really confirms just the coincidental nature, to far too great to be coincidental, and right down from the marina where the Gottenbos boat was there. They had another friend who had a boat, and the fisherman said, look, there's a boat out there, one of our boats. They could have taken that if they had a gas tank, which I don't think they used their boats. There are three opportunities to have a boat. So it was a really kind of an interesting experience, Dana. And the other thing that went with it is, if you once you see that, it's, he gave me the whole history of that area. It is the first area on the beach, going from the Holiday Inn, the marina, the Marriott, and then Fisherman's Hut. It's the first area on the beach with any foliage, any way of disguising things. And he told me, I mean, we went through it, and he said, you know, there have been drug deals in there, there have been illegals coming through there that hide out there. There's no way they would have left that body in there overnight. It can easily be accessed from a public road behind the main road. And so we walked, you know, once you get a sense of it, you're on the scene, you see how it, the boys knew that place. It would have been a familiar place to them, easily accessible, yet it was discreet, and you could hide. While I was there also, Dana, somebody pulled up in a boat, a speedboat, a family of two adults and four children, and they came right by that fisherman's hut, and with that particular fisherman's unit and the building, and went out in the water. And I waded out in the water. It was a perfect place to load somebody, load a body. So it was really striking. And I think the other thing is that you could see going to the scene, Natalie would never in a million years have stayed there by herself. No girl would have stayed there by herself. It was still a little too secluded. It was just strange. It wasn't much of a beach. But it was, it didn't happen. There was no way that... You know, she stayed there on the beach by herself, and of course, I don't think that story ever happened. Other than I think she was dead when they got her to the beach.
Exactly.
While she was there, it was very interesting.
Exactly. Now, you know as well as I do that Joran van der Sloot, what he gets in the news media, he usually draws some attention. And most recently on the Peter DeVries talk show, he took a glass of wine and threw it in the host's face. And that tells a lot, does it not? What does that tell to you?
Well, you know, I think everybody sees, and Jossie Mansour wrote about it, and so forth, that he's got a horrific temper. From a psychiatric forensic psychiatrist point of view, and also decoding, using the thought print method of decoding, you have to read his behavior in several ways. Now, bear in mind, I know his mother was on the show. I think his father was on the show, too.
Yep.
But they had coached him. This is his last interview. And immediately prior to this, he said, I want a trial. I would like to have had a trial. And his mother said, we should investigate the investigators, and they're all talking about a trial and all that. They had coached him, get on there, this is your last interview, behave yourself, look smart, all of that. His unconscious took over. He had to confess. He lost his temper. Now, what did he do? So I think bear in mind the search is going on, and these boys know the search is going on, and they got anxious, as Dave Holloway and Tim Miller know. Every time the search, when Tim and Dave were down there 2 years ago, they got near the water, the boys got anxious. They started searching in the water. They're searching on land. The boys aren't anxious. So you're wrong. The pressure of this is the search is going on. I think this was a message, one, that they're in the right place. I think, two, it's a total confession that he cannot keep his temper, and it overpowers him. And the other thing that I read that I think, you know, unique to my business, what did he throw? He threw a glass of liquid. He threw liquid at somebody. That in a way is symbolic. He's capable of throwing someone in the water. I think it's the way he's saying, I threw her in the water. I threw something. I threw a body carelessly, you know. And, of course, the other thing is that the investigator, Peter DeVries, also that he tried to degrade and throw something on. And just remember this. He could have picked up a ballpoint pen or a pencil, he could have thrown something at him, he could have cussed him, he could have walked around the table, stood over him, tried to intimidate him, he could have thrown a notebook at him, he could have, you know, he could have done anything. He picked up a glass and drowned him, and I think that's his confession that Natalie drowned in the ocean. And I think it's also, interestingly, a glass of red wine, symbolically, Peter DeVries was dripping in red wine, but if you read it, it represents Iran. If you really want to get symbolic and just keep reading, he's drenched in blood. I mean, red wine is like blood, as we all know, symbolic. And I think if you've got a picture of DeVries with red wine all in his face, That's what Iran deserves. For Natalie's blood to be rubbed in his face, that's what he deserves. And that's what he did to himself. I think the last thing I would say is, you know, the police call it the prison of the mind. When a criminal gets away with something, they punish themselves. And I said it, and you said it, law enforcement says it. They would punish themselves, and this is very, very self-punishing. He will continue to do this. And so was Deepak, and so was Satish in their own way. So I read it in a lot of ways. I thought it was very, very important. And it was a tip-off. Keep searching. This body's in the water.
And Dr. Andrew
Hodges. So I got a lot of meaning out of it, as you can see.
Dr. Andrew Hodges is here. He's the author of Into the Deep. We have Dr. Hodges for about another minute.
Hello.
Dr. Hodges is here for another minute or two. I'm still here, doctor. You hear me? Oh, maybe we've lost the good. Maybe we've lost a good doctor. Can you hear me, Dr. Hodges?
Daniel Rosen, you here? Let me.
you know, the guy that invented cell phones. I'd like to do a show about him sometime. Dr. Hodges, can you hear me? It looks like we've lost Dr. Hodges, but we were almost finished with his interview. Anyway, it just goes to show you that nothing is surprising that comes out of Aruba. Just check out our webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com, and you'll see some daily commentaries that I've done on that. We're going to take a break, and we'll be back here in a minute with our Stephanie Good. She's that New York Times bestselling author, attorney, and her book, A Rush to Injustice, covers the Duke lacrosse scandal and that disgraced DA, Mike Nifong. We're going to talk a little bit about him and his bankruptcy claim and some other things. That'll be here in a minute on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back.
It's the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. And now back to the show.
If you've been following the news lately and have heard the name Mike Nifong pop up again, it seems that our disgraced DA has, because of all his legal fees and lawsuits and whatever, has declared bankruptcy. And when I heard what his debt was, it was unbelievable. And for a millisecond, I actually felt somewhat sorry for him. I thought I'd bring on Stephanie Good tonight. Of course, she's the author of Rush to Injustice, Exposed, and she's an attorney. And I hear that she's going to be on Dancing with the Stars one of these days.
No, thank you.
I'm kidding about that, to talk about Mike Nifong. Hi, Steph. How are you?
Hi, Dana. I'm good. How are you?
I think you'd be great on Dancing with the Stars. You could.
Have you seen me dance lately? I don't think so.
Well, I don't know. You and Larry could go on there and see. You know, he'd probably step on your feet all the time. But
probably brother sister team on that show. That could be fun. I think. Didn't you have someone on there like that?
I'm trying to think. I don't know. I never watched the show, to be quite honest with you. So, our old friend Mike Nifong is back in the news. He's declared, or is trying to declare, personal bankruptcy. His debt was unbelievable. Holy man. You know, even the lawsuits and stuff, it was in the millions of dollars. Of course, you've talked about this in your book, A Rush to Injustice. Your thoughts on Mr. Nifong?
Oh, gosh, you know, my thoughts on Mr. Nifong. He's totally corrupt. He was an official, you know. He was the district attorney of Durham. He's really a pathetic, corrupt person who just has no conception of justice, and I'm not a bit surprised that he's declaring bankruptcy and he's, you know, burying his head in the sand once again and running away from any responsibility. He doesn't want to face anything. He doesn't want to face a lawsuit. Whether or not he wins or loses, has money, doesn't have money, he's a coward, and he's running, and he's hiding, and that's pretty standard for the way he's treated this whole affair.
I'm sure the laws are different in each state, but or maybe they're not. But when it comes to declaring bankruptcy when you're being sued, that's are you even able to declare bankruptcy when you're part of litigation?
Well, you know, that's I think the big issue here. But another issue here is I don't think you can do it to get out of certain kind of criminal type, you know, behavior, malicious and willful injury to people and all of that. So I really don't think that he's going to be able to walk away that easily. If the kids can prove that his behavior towards them was actually malicious and willful, I don't think that they're going to just, you know, let him get away with this. I don't think he'll be able to declare bankruptcy as far as their lawsuits are concerned. But I don't know, because, you know, as you say, you don't know how you don't know the different laws in different states, and you also don't know
You know, how a judge is going to rule, it's a, you know, tough issue.
The coach has also been in the news here lately, and it seems like this tragedy, for exactly what it is still spiraling, and lawsuits are flying. And a lawsuit, as you know, as an attorney, isn't something that's just settled within a day or two. These things can go on for years. What is this doing to the university itself as far as the image goes? Has the university's image rebounded, and what are the boys up to now?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the university's image has rebounded. I know, you know, I've been in touch with a lot of people who are involved with Duke University, and a lot of them are very angry. A lot of them want Broadhead, the president, to step down.
Yeah.
They're very furious that the university did not stand behind the boys in this matter and just basically sent them home. So, you know, I don't know how that's hurt them financially or whatever, but I know that there are a lot of people that are really disgusted with the way these boys were treated. I forgot, what was your other part of that question?
Well, what we hear now, Stephanie, is, of course, Nifong and the coach and other things, but we haven't heard much about the boys themselves lately as far as what's been going on with them. Can you fill us in as far as what's happening?
I really, honestly, as far as, you know, the last I heard, because I have not been in touch, you know, they were moving on with their lives. I heard that Finnerty and Seligman were going to school, not Duke, and that Dave Evans was working at a job. So, you know, I believe their lives are going on, and I think that their lives are going to do very well in spite of this. I think they're going to be a lot stronger because of this, but they've learned a tough lesson, a lesson that nobody should ever have to learn, and it's a shame that they were made examples of and that they were, you know, just treated so poorly, and that this guy did, you know, Nifong did what he did just to win an election. Keep his pension and keep his, you know, keep his job and stay where he was, and he took down three boys and their families and their team and their coach. You know, a lot of people suffered because of this. But I do think the boys are going to come out the other end of this fine. I really do.
You know, we look at these types of stories, and eventually they turn into a movie or a book or whatever. And Mike Nifong, the best he should be doing right now is filling the towel dispenser at the corner Texaco station. But there's that possibility. And again, I know with civil litigation that it may not come to this, but he may benefit in the long run from this whole thing if it comes to, you know, a movie deal or whatever. Is that something wrong with today's society, or is he eligible just the same as everybody else? You know, what he should be doing is, like I say, filling the towel dispenser or looking out a set of bars.
Yeah, I well, for one thing, I don't think he should benefit from this at all. And honestly, even if he benefited in some financial fashion, I don't think that will ever make him okay.
Yeah.
I think he's suffering emotionally, financially, you know, and I really don't believe that even if he is able to have a movie or a book made on his story, that it's ever going to heal him. I think he's a very troubled man. He's obviously a very sick man. And, you know, as far as people going after him now to make a book or a movie, well, you know, in my opinion, it's the same thing as somebody trying to make a movie on Jeroen van der Sloot's life story. I wouldn't pay to see it, and I know that people would boycott it. And, you know, who wants to see the bad guy win? Who wants to see what they can come out, you know, what they can accomplish now and how they can gain from the misfortune that they've caused to others? So it's unfortunate, though, that there are a lot of people out there that would go after Nifong probably to make a big deal with him.
Yep.
Financially. I personally wouldn't want to hear his story or read about him.
you know, you and I have done many interviews and talked, of course, your book Exposed talks about the dangers of the internet and the work that you do to catch the pedophiles. But there's been a news story that's been out here in the last little while about mass suicides in a small town in England. These young folks, you know, late teens, early 20s, and they've been hanging themselves. I think it's up to 13 now. Now, whether the internet has a direct correlation to this or not, there's certainly these sorts of sects and groups and mailing lists and, well, you name it, the psycho crazy stuff that's out there right now. I'm curious if you could comment on that story. And have ISPs, there's also another story coming out, and I'm not sure if it was Charter or who it was, one of the big ISPs in the United States, talking about filtering content. Will that help?
Well, I don't believe you can really catch all the bad things that are going on. We're just talking internet now. Is
right.
that what we're...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that you're ever going to be able to filter it to a point that you can catch everything bad that's going on the internet. I mean, certainly there are ways to filter certain things, but, you know, everybody has ways of getting around those things. I mean, so far, just like a virus can infect a computer and you buy a Norton or a McAfee and then the next day there's another virus out there that's going after it. I don't believe, you know, I think that the most important thing really where the computer is concerned is for people to know how to use the computer properly, to understand the dangers and to be aware of them. That's just what I've seen. I'd like to believe that all of these things that are coming out will stop all the bad things from happening. But, you know, we've seen so much already. We've seen there are parental controls and all sorts of filters and places where children are not supposed to have access to. And we've seen that they can get access to them. The adults get access to the kids. There's no door that's going to close completely. And unless, you know, we have to watch out for our kids. And that just goes out of the home, too. The teachers have to watch out for the kids. Everywhere a child is able to use the internet, there should be something out there that can watch over them. And unfortunately, that's just not possible. So, you know, as much as I like to believe that there are things, you know, on the outside of our lives that will stop all these bad things from coming in, the bottom line is that we have to teach the kids. The kids have to know how to use this. It's a tool. It's just like teaching them how to drive a car. A car can be a wonderful tool. It can be a deadly, you know, a weapon, too. And so if you don't teach them properly, they're not going to use it properly. They're not going to understand how to use it, and they're going to be susceptible to the danger. So, you know, I hate to sound so skeptical. You're talking to somebody who's just had the worst experiences on the internet and has seen
right.
such a bad side of it. But you have to also remember, it's not just because I went on the internet and had a bad experience. I have worked on the internet for years, and I don't go after people. Some people think that I'm skeptical and I have this pessimistic view because I'm going after bad guys all day long. No, they come after me. They see a child's screen name and they bombard me. So I'm just a normal child as far as they're concerned. I'm just sitting out there and they're coming after me. So, you know, this attitude that I have doesn't come from just one bad experience as a child or something like that. It's from a lot of experiences of portraying a child and, you know, just sitting there and being a, you know, a willing participant in a conversation.
And you know,
I hate to sound so pessimistic, but that's just the way the internet is now. It's a terrible place where kids are concerned, you know, for a great many of them.
And we have to, like you say, we have to teach, but also, you know, we look at the stories and the teachers need to be taught again because we see the continual problems with teachers and children and all that. But besides that fact, I'm not sure if you can talk about this or not, but we're going to see a little bit more about you when it comes to the work that you've been doing catching pedophiles. Can you comment on that?
I can comment a little bit. I actually CBS has been filming me for an upcoming, news documentary on my work with the FBI. And it is going to be shown on WE, Women's Entertainment Network.
Right.
Probably sometime in March, but we don't have a definite date yet. And I'm very excited about it. We're not even finished filming yet. It's just a very, very exciting project. I'm very honored to have been asked to do this. It's a whole documentary about me. Still a little surreal, but it's happening.
Well, it's about bloody time, because you've been out there doing the work, and not to focus on Dateline, but there have been, you've got the 100% conviction rate, and you've been doing it right, and I congratulate you for this project, and I look forward to seeing it, although I've never been a big Wii TV watcher, but in this case, I think I will.
Well, I was doing this long before Dateline was doing it. That's a thing, I was doing this very quietly and just working with the FBI for a long time before these things came up on Dateline. So I am very proud of the fact that it's being recognized. I didn't go after this. I didn't go looking for it. And it's just a surprise to me that just some simple person can sit in their house and do this kind of work and be found and recognized. And, it's an incredible thing.
Absolutely, and it's long overdue. Stephanie Good, New York Times bestselling author of A Rush to Injustice, Exposed, Aruba, and soon to be on the Women's Entertainment Channel and Dancing with the Stars. No, I'm kidding about that part of it. I better stop that part of it.
I'll go on if you go on.
Absolutely. We'll be a team. Thanks, Steph.
Okay.
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And long overdue. She was doing that long before Dateline NBC was. Anyway, that's it. That's another Dana Pretzer show in the can. That's a radio term. I wasn't in there when we did the show tonight, obviously. I want to thank my guests this evening, Jackie Hollander, Andrew Hodges, who we had a cell phone problem with, and our Stephanie Good, New York Times best-selling author. Again, her books are A Rush to Injustice and Exposed. Go to ScaredMonkeys.com or ScaredMonkeysRadio.com to learn more about my guests this evening and to listen to tonight's show, the podcast, and my daily commentary. Thank you, and we'll see you again real soon here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of ScaredMonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.